saw was also hung on the wall. He fell out of a Chinook helicopter after it was hit by two rocket-propelled grenades during Operation Anaconda in Afghanistan, and was killed by Taliban fighters at the start of the war. As we lined up at the head of the table, I saw all these senior guys with long hair and beards. Tattoos covered most of their arms, and only a few were in uniform. Toward the end of Green Team, we all started growing out our hair and beards. The grooming standards have changed several times over the years, but at this point in the war, people were less worried about your haircut and more worried about your actions on the battlefield. It was a ragtag bunch of professionals. We all came from different backgrounds, and we had different hobbies and interests, but what we had in common was a willingness to sacrifice our time and even our lives for a greater good. In the team room, the guys made us introduce ourselves and give them a brief bio. Charlie, the bully, was the first to speak, and he barely got out his name before he was met with a chorus of boos and jeers from the senior guys. "Shut up," they yelled. "We don't care." It went that way for all of us. But afterward, the guys were shaking our hands and helping us get our gear unpacked. It was all in fun, and besides, everybody was too busy to worry about it. There was a war going on, and no time to be wasted with petty new guy treatment. I felt at home. This was the kind of command I'd wanted to be a part of since I joined the Navy. Here, there were no limits on how good you could be and what you could contribute. For me, all of the fear of failure was now replaced with the desire to perform and excel. What I had learned during the 3-day screening more than a year ago was even more true in the squadron. Just meeting the standards wasn't good enough. As I unpacked my gear, I realized I had to prove myself all over again. Just because I got through Green Team didn't mean shit. All of the other guys in the room completed the same course. I made a promise to myself that I would be an asset to the team and that I'd work my ass off. Chapter 3. The Second Deck. A few weeks before we were scheduled to deploy to Afghanistan, I printed out the packing list. It was 2005, and I was preparing for my first deployment to the Central Asian country. While at SEAL Team 5, my only combat deployment had been to Iraq. Standing next to the printer, I watched as the paper rolled out. 6 single-spaced pages later, I started to gather up my gear. The suggested packing list basically told us to bring everything. We worked under big boy rules at the command, which means that there wasn't a lot of management unless you needed it. Since getting to the team, I prided myself on being independent. For the last 3 months, I had trained hard and tried to be an asset. I learned that it was okay to ask questions if you have them, but you didn't want to be the guy who didn't know what was going on and was always asking. I didn't want to make a mistake on my first deployment by not packing something, so when I saw my team leader in the team room, I asked him about the packing list. "Hey," I said, grabbing a cup of coffee, "I was getting my kit together and the packing list basically wants me to load everything." He was sitting at the granite countertop sipping a cup of coffee and going over some paperwork. Short and stocky, unlike some of the other guys who had longer hair and thick beards, he was clean-cut, with a short haircut and a close shave. He also wasn't the most talkative guy, and he had been at DevGru for much longer than I'd been in the Navy. He took big boy rules seriously. "How long have you been in the Navy?" he said. "Going on 6 years," I said. "You've been a SEAL for 6 years, and you don't know what you need on deployment?" I felt like an asshole. "Dude, what do you think you need to bring for deployment?" "Load it," he said. "This is your guide. Bring what you think you need." "Check," I said. Back at my cage, I laid out my gear, called kit. Each operator at DevGru had a cage, sort of like a locker big enough to walk inside. It was the size of a small room with shelves that lined the walls and a small hanging rod that ran along the back wall to hang uniforms. Bags of gear filled with everything I needed for the different missions we could be called upon to perform rested on the shelves. One bag had everything I needed for CQB. Another had my HAHO, High Altitude, High Opening, or jump gear. My combat swimmer, or dive kit, was in a separate large green gear bag. Everything was color-coded and ready. My OCD was definitely in overdrive, and I had everything perfectly organized and separated. But some of the gear, like a Gerber tool, came in handy on most missions. Back at SEAL Team 5, you were issued one Gerber tool, which had a knife blade, screwdriver, scissors, and can opener. You were also only issued one scope for your rifle, one fixed-blade knife, one set of ballistic plates. That meant sorting through multiple bags to find the single item that you needed to transfer to a new bag containing the specialty gear for a given mission. It was a hassle and was not very efficient, but it was the U.S. government, and I'd gotten used to it. But it was different at DevGru. My team leader came by my cage later that day to double-check how I was doing and saw my loadouts in the color-coded bags. Off to the side, I had an extra bag with the gear I thought I'd need for most missions, including a Gerber tool. "Go down to supply and get a Gerber for each bag," my team leader said. I looked at him, confused. "I can go get four of them?" "Yeah. You got four different mission loadout bags. You need one Gerber for each bag," he said. My team leader signed my request form, and I walked down to the supply office. One of the support guys met me at the window. "What do you need?" I showed him the list. It was basic stuff like flashlights and other tools, but I wanted four of each. "Okay," he said without hesitation. "Be right back." In a few minutes, he came back with a plastic bin full of everything on the list. I had to fight to keep from smiling too much. This was a dream come true. Back at our previous teams, guys spent thousands of their own dollars buying kit materials we needed for work. The armory was even better. Above the door was a sign: "You dream, we build." For a gun geek like me, it was heaven. I had them set up my two M4 assault rifles, one with a 14-inch barrel and one with a 10-inch barrel. I got an MP7 submachine gun and a collection of handguns, including the standard-issue Navy SEAL Sig Sauer P226. My primary weapon that I used daily was a suppressed Heckler & Koch HNK416 with the 10-inch barrel and an EOTech optical red dot sight with a 3x magnifier. My HNK416 with a 14-inch barrel I set up for long-range shooting. It was also suppressed, and on top I mounted a 2.5x10 Night Force scope. I also set up my 14-inch HNK416 with an infrared laser and a clip-on thermal sight that allowed for more precise night shooting. I didn't use the gun much because my primary weapon, with the 10-inch barrel, worked for most missions, but it was nice to have a gun ready with a little more range if I needed it. I ran with a suppressed MP7 submachine gun on a few missions, but it lacked the knockdown power of my HNK416. The submachine gun came in handy during shipboarding, in the jungle, or when weight, size, and the ability to stay extremely quiet were needed. Several times we shot fighters in one room with a suppressed MP7, and their comrades next door didn't wake up. The HNK-416s didn't compare to the MP7 when you were trying to be extremely quiet. Rounding out my guns were two pistols, the Sig Sauer P226 and an HNK-45C. Both were suppressor-capable, and I typically carried the 45. I also carried an M79 grenade launcher, which was called a pirate gun because it looked like a blunderbuss. Our armorers cut the barrels short and modified the stock into a pistol grip. Of course, none of my guns were standard issues. We all had individual modifications on the trigger and grips. I know for a fact the armorers took great pride in taking care of the tools that took care of us. Without a doubt, DevGru had the best tools in the business. As you walked around the command, it wasn't uncommon to hear rounds being shot at the indoor and outdoor ranges, or hear the thud of a breaching charge going off in the kill house. Training was constant. It wasn't unusual to see guys walking between training events dressed in full kit with their loaded weapons slung in front of them. Everything was geared toward war fighting or training for it. I was just getting the hang of things at the squadron in 2005 when I found myself on a plane headed overseas to Afghanistan. At the time, our unit was focused on Afghanistan, and the Army's Delta Force was in Iraq. Delta hit a rough patch that year and had taken several casualties in a short time. They requested additional assaulters, and DevGru rogered up and my team was selected to go. My squadron didn't want my first deployment to be with Delta, so I spent some time acting as a floater working with my troop in Afghanistan. Given Delta's needs, I eventually left Afghanistan with two other SEALs and headed to Iraq to help out. We got into Baghdad well after midnight. The ride from the helicopter pad was dark as we weaved through the deserted streets of the Green Zone. It was summer, and the humidity hung like a blanket over everything. Sitting in the bed of a pickup truck with our gear, the breeze felt good. Everything felt and smelled the same as my first combat deployment to Baghdad with Team 5 in 2003. We had arrived just after the invasion started. Our first mission was to secure the Mukattayin hydroelectric dam northeast of the Iraqi capital. Our chain of command was afraid retreating Iraqi forces might destroy the dam to slow the American advance. The plan was simple. Based on our experience, which was zero, we planned to fly to the X, which is a tactic that means we insert directly onto the target, keeping speed and surprise in our favor. In this case, the X was the dam, and once over the target in a helicopter, we planned a fast rope into the courtyard. From there, we'd rush the main building and clear and secure it. Nearby, the Grom, Poland's Special Operations Unit, would clear another cluster of buildings, while another group of SEALs would secure the outer perimeter using two dune buggies. After a few days of waiting for the weather to clear up, we got the word to go. Climbing into the MH-53, I could feel my heart beating quickly. I'd been waiting for this moment since I was a kid reading about ambushes in the Mekong Delta. I was about to launch on my first real combat operation. I'd thought about it, read about it, and now here I was, about to do it for real. I probably should have been scared, or at least concerned about the unknown, but it felt good to finally do it for real. I didn't just want to practice the game, I wanted to actually play in the game, and this was going to be my first taste. The flight took several hours and included a mid-air refueling link-up. My team of 20 guys was crammed tightly inside the helicopter. The fuel smell wafted into the cabin as the helicopter filled its tanks using the boom in front of the cockpit. It was pitch black inside the cabin, and I zoned out for most of the flight until we got the signal to get ready. 2 minutes! The crew chief screamed, signaling with his hands and turning on a red light. It was well after midnight as the helicopter approached the dam. I took my position at the door and grabbed the rope. I couldn't hear anything over the roar of the engines. Like the rest of my teammates, I was loaded down with breaching gear and our chemical protective suits. The good idea fairy, which is what we called the tendency for planners to add their 2 cents about every possible contingency, weighing the team down with options and extra gear and good ideas, had struck often on this mission. We were loaded down with quickie saws to break open the dam's gates. We had to carry food and water for a few days. We didn't know how long we'd be there, so we needed to be self-sufficient. The rule is, when in doubt, load it out. Of course, the more you carry, the greater a toll it takes on your body. The slower you move, the harder it is to react quickly to a threat. As the helicopter slowed to a hover, I grabbed the rope with both hands and slid down to the ground. We were about 30 feet up, and I could see the ground coming quickly. I tried to slow my descent, but I didn't want to be so slow that my teammates would crash down on top of me. With all my gear, I landed like a ton of bricks. My legs ached as I brought my gun up and started toward the gate less than 100 yards away. As soon as I stepped out from under the helicopter, the rotor wash beat me down. Small rocks pelted my body and dust tore at my eyes. I could barely make out the gate ahead of me. As I started to run toward it, the rotor wash pushed me forward into an uncontrolled sprint. It took every effort to stay on my feet, and I literally skidded to a halt at the locked gate. The others were close behind me. I snapped the lock off the gate with my bolt cutters, then took point and headed toward a cluster of buildings. The main building was 2 stories and had the drab architecture of an Eastern Bloc country made of concrete, and the door was metal. While my teammates covered me, I tried the handle. It was open. I didn't know what I would find as I stepped into a long hall. We could start taking fire at any second. I could see several rooms on either side. As we started to move forward, we saw movement in one of the far rooms. 2 hands came out first, followed by several Iraqi guards. They had their hands above their heads, and they were unarmed. My teammates ushered them behind me as I continued down the hall. Inside the rooms, I found their AK-47 rifles. None of the weapons had a round in the chamber. It looked like they'd been sleeping and had woken when they heard the helicopters overhead. It took a long time to clear the building because of the size. We paid special attention to detail because we were looking for explosives rigged to blow up the dam. We'd never cleared anything this size, so it took a little longer than expected. No one was injured, except for one of the Grom guys who broke his ankle fast roping to the target. After we cleared the main building, my platoon chief came up to me. "Hey, check my radio," he said. "I'm not getting comms." When we launched, he had his radio strapped to his back. As he stood in front of me now, I could still see the headphone cord dangling over his shoulder. I looked on his back, and the whole pack was gone. All I could see was the cable. "Your backpack is gone," I said.
"Gone? What do you mean?" he said.
"It's gone," I said. He hadn't strapped the backpack to his body armor correctly. Body armor has nylon loops about a half inch apart on the front and back so that you can secure pouches to the vest. My chief had only laced his backpack through the top and bottom loops, so when he fast roped down into the rotor wash, it blew this backpack and radio off his back and into the water below the dam. The radio at the bottom of the river wasn't going to do us much good. The same thing happened to our medic. He lost a bunch of morphine in a similar backpack. A lot of the gear we were using on the mission was new to us. Just before we deployed, boxes of new stuff had shown up in the team room. The common mantra was, train like you fight, which means don't go into battle with equipment you haven't used before, preferably extensively. We'd broken the rule, and I knew we'd gotten extremely lucky that it didn't bite us in the ass. It was our first lesson learned. That wasn't the only way we were lucky on the mission. The Iraqis had anti-aircraft guns near the dam loaded and ready. Had the guards wanted to fight, they could have knocked the helicopters out of the sky as we fast roped down. We learned a million lessons on that mission, from the need for better intelligence about a target to how to secure equipment. And we'd learned them all without losing anybody. Usually the best lessons are learned at the toughest moments. But I didn't like how much luck had played a role in keeping us alive on that mission, and my perfectionist tendencies took an ego hit. As the helicopter took off to take us back to Kuwait 3 days later, I realized that even though each of my teammates on Team 5 had different amounts of time and experience in the SEAL teams, we were all still very new to this, and this raid was a first for everyone. Chapter 4. Delta. Now, back in Baghdad 2 years later, I was a little more seasoned, but not much. I'd screened for and then completed Green Team, but I was definitely still the new guy. The good part was I had some experience working in the Iraqi capital from my days on Team 5. After the dam mission, my team was sent to Baghdad to help round up former regime loyalists and insurgent leaders. Delta's base was in the Green Zone, which sat next to the Tigris River in the center of the city. Soon after I landed, I started to immediately get my bearings. The base was a short distance from the famed Crossed Swords, erected to celebrate Iraq's victory in the Iran-Iraq War. The sword arch stood on opposite sides of a large parade ground. During the day, you'd see whole units posing for pictures near the pair of hands holding the curved blades. The hands and forearms were modeled on the dictator's, including his exact thumbprint. Delta's headquarters was in former Ba'ath Party buildings. I walked inside to check in at the Joint Operations Center. John, my new team leader, came up to meet me soon after I arrived. I was brand new and still had no idea what to expect. A former Ranger before joining Delta Force, John had a thick barrel chest and thick arms. A brown, bushy beard that was so long it brushed against the top of his chest covered his face. He looked like a taller version of Gimli, the angry dwarf in The Lord of the Rings. John had joined the army right out of high school. After years of short haircuts and lots of rules with the Rangers, he dropped his packet for warrant officer school with an eye toward being an Apache helicopter pilot. But ultimately, he didn't want to give up his gun. So he screened and got picked up for Delta and had worked his way up the ranks.
"Welcome to paradise," he said, as we walked toward the team room. "Hot enough for you?"
"At least you guys have AC," I said. "Last time I was here, I lived in a tent. We didn't get AC for weeks."
A little better living here, he said, opening the door to our room.
The room was in one wing of the palace. The hallways were wide with marble floors and high ceilings. I was going to share a room with him and the newest guy on their team. My bunk bed was in the near corner, and I tossed my bags next to it. John helped me wheel my gear into the room before showing me around the place. The palace had its own gym, chow hall, and pool. In fact, there was more than one pool. Each team had two rooms. There were five guys on the team. One of them was a former British Royal Marine who had dual citizenship. He came to the United States, enlisted, and eventually worked his way into the ranks of Delta. The other guys were like John, a mix of former Rangers and Special Forces soldiers. The newest guy was a Ranger who was wounded in Somalia during the Black Hawk Down battle. He looked like an Amish guy with a bowl haircut and a patchy beard that never seemed to grow together. After making small talk, I spent the rest of the night getting my gear in order. First, I unpacked my op gear in a cubby in the hallway outside of the room so that if something went down, I'd be able to throw on my gear and be out the door. After that was squared away, I unpacked my clothes and set up my bed. Since we had bunk beds, most of us used the top bunk for storage and hung a poncho liner over the bottom so we had a little privacy. It was close to dawn when I was finally done. Since we worked vampire hours, sleep all day and work at night, most of the guys were racking out. The room had a couch and a TV. I grabbed a cup of coffee and was watching TV when John came over.
"We'll get you plugged in tomorrow," John said. "Let me know when you need anything."
"Thanks," I said.
"We've been busy," John said. "This was a rare day off. I'm sure we'll be out tomorrow night."
There was no easing into it. Most days I'd get up in the afternoon and wander out to the pool with my iPod speakers. I chilled to some Red Hot Chili Peppers or Linkin Park while I stretched out on an air mattress. I'd float a while, getting some sun and relaxing. One of my teammates started to take care of the grass around the pool as a hobby. In a country of sand and dirt, having a little grass to walk on was a real treat. Some days, I could smell fresh-cut grass as I floated. Then I'd eat breakfast and work out in the gym or run. I tried to get to the range as many times a week as possible. By dusk, missions would start spinning up, and we'd knock out one operation, two if we were lucky. I was part of the roof team, which meant we rode on pods above the skid on an MH-6 Little Bird. We would land on the roof of a target compound and then assault down. The rest of the force would arrive in armored vehicles and clear the ground floor and assault up. The Little Bird is a light helicopter used for special operations in the United States Army. It has a distinct egg-like cockpit and two pods or bench seats on the outside. On the attack variant, the pods or seats are replaced with rockets and machine guns. Pilots from the 160th Special Operations Aviation Regiment, or SOAR, flew the helicopters. The 160th Special Operations Aviation Regiment flies most of the missions for JSOC. We've worked together for years, and the 160th pilots are the best in the world. Headquartered at Fort Campbell, Kentucky, the 160th SOAR Airborne are known as the Night Stalkers, because almost all of their missions are done at night. I'd worked with Little Birds briefly in Green Team, but in Baghdad I found myself perched on the skid almost every night as the city passed underneath me in a blur. It was past midnight a few nights after I arrived, and all I could hear was the roar of the engine and the wind. At 70 miles per hour, the wind battered me as my feet dangled off the side of the seat. I knew calm, clear decision-making was the key. But that was hard when it felt like I was riding a roller coaster into a fight. I tightened the sling on my gun, keeping it pinned to my chest, and checked the safety lanyard that would hopefully keep me attached to the helicopter in the event I slid off my seat. Sitting on the pod, I could see the other Little Bird on our right flank flying in formation in the green hue of my night vision goggles. From the other helicopter, one of the Delta guys saw me looking and flipped me the bird. I returned the salute. On this hit, we were after a high-level weapons facilitator, just another link in the chain funding the insurgency. He was holed up in a cluster of two-story houses near the center of the city with several fighters and a large weapons cache. Our team was tasked with flying via Little Bird to the roof and assaulting down. Another team would come via a Pander, an armored truck with 50-caliber machine guns and Mark 19 grenade launchers. They'd wait about half a minute for us to breach the roof door, creating a diversion, before they would breach the bottom floor and we'd clear our way to the middle. Below me, the city stretched out in a tangle of roads and alleyways built around clusters of squat buildings. Every once in a while, the city would open up into an abandoned lot choked with trash. I was at the front of the pod near the cockpit. On the opposite side was John. 1 minute, I heard the pilot say over my radio. He calmly pointed a single finger out his door and in front of my face to make sure I got the call. From my position, I could see the co-pilot pointing a laser at the roof of the target. Night after night, the pilots managed to navigate to the exact rooftop through a sea of thousands. I had no idea how they did it, since everything looked the same to me from above. I could feel the helicopter start to descend toward the empty rooftop. Coming to a hover, the pilot was able to perform a lip landing by placing the skids on the edge of the rooftop. Instead of fast roping, we stepped onto the skid and then jumped to the roof. In less than 10 seconds, the whole 4-man team was on the roof and the little bird was gone. Racing to the door, the breacher set our charge and blew it open. Seconds later, I heard the charge blow on the first floor, followed by shots being fired. John was up front as we started down the stairs. "We're on the wrong roof," John said, only a few steps inside. The shooting was coming from the house next door. I heard several small explosions that had to be hand grenades as we ran to the corner of the roof. "We're one building too far," John said. We moved to see how we could support our teammates in the building next door. The houses looked the same from the air, and for the first time, the pilots had inserted us on the wrong one. We had approached from the south and landed on the building just to the north of our target. "We need to move to the adjacent building," John said. "We're not useful staying here." The adjacent building was east of the target and 3 stories tall, which allowed us to cover down at the target house. "We've got an eagle down," I heard over the radio. That meant someone had been hit. It turned out one of the Delta operators was shot in the calf. Others had been peppered with shrapnel from the hand grenades. Insurgents in the house were throwing grenades down the stairwell, slowing the operator's advance as they finished clearing the first floor and moved toward the second. The ground team started to work a medevac and pulled back away from the stairs. We were able to race around the block and clear the 3-story building to the east of the target. Explosions and gunfire echoed through the buildings. From the roof of the building, we started to scan for targets. I could see IR lasers tracking over the windows of the compound as my teammates looked for targets. Every few minutes, one of the insurgents would stick an AK-47 out of the second floor window and unleash a long burst. "Allahu Akbar," they'd scream after spraying rounds down at the assaulters below. It was a stalemate. The team on the ground couldn't run up the stairs, and there was no way we could get on the roof to fight down. Over the radio, I heard calls to an army mechanized infantry unit 10 blocks away. The soldiers were providing the outer ring of security. We always like to have 2 rings of security. This night, the near ring was a squad of rangers who set up on the corners of the target area. A mile beyond that were M1 tanks and Bradley fighting vehicles, which were armored personnel carriers with a 20-millimeter turret gun. "Bring up a Bradley," I heard over the radio. I could hear the Bradley's tracks chewing up the asphalt as it approached the house. "I want you to level the second floor," the assault leader yelled to the Bradley's commander, perched in the hatch on top of the turret. Smashing through a stone wall on the south side of the house, it stopped in the courtyard and unleashed a short burst from its 20-millimeter cannon. The rounds easily smashed through the walls of the second floor, tearing large gashes in the concrete. Pulling back, I saw the assault leader run up to the Bradley. "Keep shooting," the commander yelled into the hatch. "What?" the gunner said. "I want you to level the whole second floor," the assault leader repeated. "Level it." The Bradley crunched back over the rubble again and started to fire. One of the insurgents screamed, "Allahu Akbar," and started to spray bullets out the window. This time, there was no let-up from the Bradley. Guys started to cheer as the rounds hit in successive explosions. In a few minutes, the Bradley went Winchester, which is the military term for running out of ammunition. We brought up a second Bradley, and it shot until it went Winchester as well. By the time the second Bradley pulled back, a raging fire had erupted on the second floor. Black smoke poured out of the windows and started to billow into the sky. From our position on the roof, we could still hear the insurgents yelling. I was perched on the northeast corner, holding down on the back side of the house.
It was hard to see because of the thick black smoke.
Suddenly, I saw a man's head and torso emerge from a window. Without thinking, I put my laser on his chest and opened fire. I could see the bullets hit him, and he flopped back into the room, disappearing into the smoke. After my volley of fire, John raced over beside me.
"What you got?"
"Saw a guy in the back window," I said.
"You sure?"
he said, scanning the same window with his laser.
"Yeah. You get him?"
"Pretty sure," I said.
"Okay, stay put."
John went back to his post, and I kept searching for new targets. I didn't have time to dwell on it, nor did I have any feelings about it. This was the first person I'd ever shot, and with all the time I'd spent thinking about how it would make me feel, it really didn't make me feel anything. I knew that these guys in the house had already tried to kill my friends on the first floor, and they wouldn't hesitate to do the same to me.
Even after the two Bradleys and the fire, we still heard yelling, followed by bursts of enemy fire.
Tactically, it didn't make sense to assault up the stairs.
"They're gonna blow the building," John said.
John decided to pull us off the roof rather than expose us to the blast. We joined the others on the ground. I watched as a small breach team, led by one of Delta's explosive ordnance disposal guys, ran into the first floor to set a thermobaric charge. The charge produces a huge shockwave, capable of collapsing an entire building. A few minutes later, the charge was set, and the breach team ran back and took cover next to me. Hunkered behind the pander, I could hear him counting down.
I waited for the explosion.
Nothing.
Everybody stared at the EOD tech. We all had the same confused look on our faces. I saw John walk toward him.
"What the hell?"
John said.
"The time must have been wrong," I heard him mumble.
I'm sure his mind was running a million miles an hour. He was trying to figure out why the charge didn't blow.
"Did you dual prime?"
John asked. Everybody was trained to dual prime explosives, which meant attaching two detonators to the charge in case one fails. The rule of thumb was simple. One is none, two is one. But that didn't help us now. We had to make a decision. Do we send more guys back into the house to reset the charge, or do we wait it out and see what happens? We had no idea if the insurgents moved downstairs and were now waiting for the assaulters to return, or if the EOD set the wrong time and it would go off unexpectedly with men inside. Finally, they decided to send the EOD tech back inside to attach a new detonator. Again, the breach team ran back inside. We continued to cover the house, and minutes later the breach team was back behind the pander.
"You think it's gonna go this time?" John asked, with a smirk.
"Yeah, I am pretty positive," the EOD tech said. "Dual primed it." On time, the charge exploded, and the house crumbled onto itself, sending out a massive cloud covering us in thin, talc-like dust. I watched the cloud rise into the sky and hang in the muggy morning air.
By now, the sun was starting to come up.
We moved in to sift through the rubble looking for bodies and weapons. There were at least six dead fighters. Most of the bodies were up on the second floor. Their faces were covered in soot. John noticed the sandbags near some of the bodies.
"Hey, look at this. They had the whole second floor barricaded," he said. "We're lucky the pilots made a mistake. It probably saved our lives."
"Why?"
I asked. "If we'd actually landed on the right building," John said, "the four of us would have assaulted into a barricaded position on the second floor. We might have had surprise on our side, but the odds wouldn't have looked good once we made entry. Without a doubt in my mind, we would have taken more casualties."
I was quiet. I looked up to John, and here he was saying, "We were lucky. A mistake had probably saved our lives." It was nothing but a bit of random luck. After clearing the rubble, the ride back to the base in Panders was quiet. We were hungry and tired. All of our faces were covered in soot. Usually there was more smack-talking and excitement after taking down such a dynamic target. I let what happened start creeping into my mind. As we rode, John's words kept echoing in my head. Had the mission gone perfectly, we would have landed the little bird on the roof and entered the door on the second floor only to come face to face with at least four heavily armed insurgents. A 4-on-4 gunfight with automatic weapons in a room no bigger than a bedroom, never ends well. By the time we parked back at our base, I had finished my mental gymnastics. I simply blocked out what could have happened and moved on to what I learned. Sometimes something random can save your life. And always dual prime a charge. At the end of the deployment, I flew back to Pope Air Force Base in North Carolina, where Delta is based. When we got off the plane, members of their unit greeted me just like I was one of their own. Before I boarded my flight to Virginia Beach, John handed me a plaque. It was a copy of a pencil drawing of a Delta operator and a little bird. It was framed with green matting and a Delta Force unit coin. "I want you to have this," John said. "Anybody who runs with this team gets one." Master Sergeant Randy Shugart, a Delta sniper, made the drawing, and the original was found after he was killed in Somalia. Shugart was awarded the Medal of Honor during the Battle of Mogadishu. When the Black Hawk crashed, he volunteered to defend the crash site until help arrived. He was killed by a mob of Somalis. Before the attacks on September 11th, Delta and DevGru were rivals. We were the two kids at the top of the block, and there was a raging debate over which unit was the best. With the war, there was no more time for rivalry, and all that bullshit had gone away. They treated me like a brother during the deployment. I shook hands with John and boarded my flight to Virginia Beach. Back home at DevGru the next day, I met up with Charlie and Steve. They came over to my cage while I unpacked and got my gear back in its proper place. The squadron was just returning from its deployment in Afghanistan. Compared to my trip to Baghdad, their deployment had been relatively slow. As much fun as I had in Iraq with Delta, it was still good to be back with the boys.
"Sounds like you were busy over there," Charlie said.
"When are you moving down to Bragg with your army brothers?" Steve said.
My jokes were weak, and I knew they were talking shit. It was great to be back.
"Ha," I said. "Good to see you guys, too."
I was looking forward to leave and then a trip to Mississippi to shoot. I knew the only chance I had to shut them up was on the range. Even though we'd all just gotten home, we weren't scheduled to stay long. 2 weeks of leave is all we had before heading out to train. It was a cycle that would repeat for almost a decade.
Chapter 5. Point Man. In December 2006, we were deployed to western Iraq. It was my third deployment at the command. I had spent one rotation working closely with the CIA. It felt good to be back with the guys instead of helping the agency plan and train their Afghan fighters.
We worked with a lot of other units, but it was always better with the boys because we were cut from the same cloth.
My troop was working along the Syrian border and in some of Iraq's nastiest towns, like Ramadi, home to Al-Qaeda Iraq. Our job was to target high-level couriers that brought in foreign fighters and Iranian weapons. The Marines in Al-Anbar asked if we could help conduct an operation to clear and secure a series of houses in a village near the Syrian border. The village was a safe haven for insurgents, and several leaders were staying near the center of the town. The plan was for us to hit the houses at night, and then the Marines would surround the village and relieve us in the morning. Even with the team crowded into a Black Hawk, I was fighting to keep warm. We had a combat assault dog with us. We used it to detect bombs and help track enemy fighters. I tried to get the dog to sit on my lap to warm me up. Every time I got him close to me, the handler would pull him away. It was freezing when we landed about 4 miles from the Iraqi village. Shielding my eyes from the dust, I waited for the helicopters to leave. I could hear their engines fade away minutes later, heading east back toward Al-Assad Air Base. I stamped my feet and rubbed my hands together, trying to get the circulation moving while we got organized to move out. Even though I'd been to Iraq twice before, this third deployment was different. The enemy had evolved. So, like SEALs do best, we adapted. Instead of flying to the X like we did in the past, we'd started to land miles away and patrol in quietly. This way the enemy couldn't hear the helicopters. We were transitioning from being loud and fast, taking the enemy by surprise, to being soft and slow, and retaining the element of surprise for even longer. We could creep through their houses and into their bedrooms and wake them up before they had a chance to fight back. But patrolling to the target wasn't easy, especially in the cold winter night. The wind cut into our uniforms as we moved toward the village. I was near the front, acting as the point man for my team. One of the key lessons learned early on in a SEAL's career was the ability to be comfortable being uncomfortable.
It was a lesson I first learned as a kid in Alaska checking the trap line with my dad.
When it got cold in Iraq, or during Hell Week in Buds, my mind used to wander back to Alaska. I could always hear the roar of the snowmobile as my father and I headed toward the line of traps he kept miles from the village and deep into Alaska's wilderness. I remember how it felt like the snowmobile was floating through the fresh powder, and how, as we turned, it was like being on a surfboard cutting into a wave. The temperature hovered near zero, and our warm breath crystallized in the air.
On one cold winter day in Alaska,
I was wrapped tightly in a tan Carhartt snowsuit, winter boots, and gloves. A beaver hat, hand-sewn by my mother, covered my ears, and a scarf protected my face, leaving only my eyes exposed. I was warm except for my hands and feet. We'd been out for hours, and I could barely feel my toes. I tried to wiggle them in my thick wool socks, but it wasn't helping. Huddled behind my father to block the wind, all I could think about was how cold my hands and feet were. We'd already gotten a couple of marten, a cat-sized weasel with a bushy tail like a squirrel and a soft coat of brown fur. My father traded the pelts in the village to make a little extra money, or my mother would make hats for my sisters. But the biting cold took the thrill out of the time I was spending with my dad. Any fun I was having disappeared with the last feeling of warmth in my body. I'd begged my father to go on the trip.
"Are you sure?" he said. "You know it's gonna be cold."
"I want to go," I said. I wanted to hang out with my father and didn't want to be stuck back at the house. This was guy stuff, and he taught me how to shoot and hunt. As I got older, he trusted me to hunt and fish on my own, and I'd take the family boat up the river for a week at a time. In a way, it was my first taste of big boy rules, and I thrived. Plus, I wouldn't have to sit at home with the girls. I always wanted to be outside. I loved the outdoors, just not all the cold weather. I knew that if my dad let me come with him, I couldn't be the kid complaining about the cold. But now, a few hours into the trip, all I wanted were warm hands and feet. "Dad!" I screamed into the wind as we drove. "Dad, my feet are frozen!" My father, dressed in the same snowsuit and hat, slowed to a stop. He turned back, and I imagine he saw a small boy with his teeth chattering behind his scarf. "I'm freezing," I said.
"We only have a few more traps," my father said. "Do you think you can make it?"
I just looked at him, not wanting to answer no. I didn't want to let him down. I stared at him, hoping he'd make the choice for me. "I can't feel my feet," I said.
"Get off here and start walking behind the snowmobile. Follow my tracks. I'm gonna keep going. I won't be far ahead of you. Stick to the tracks and keep moving because that will keep your feet warm."
I slid off the back of the snow machine and adjusted the .22 rifle strapped to my back.
"You got it?"
my father asked. I nodded. He started the engine and headed toward the next trap. I started walking and my feet warmed up. Outdoorsmen pay thousands of dollars to experience the Alaska tundra, but for most of my childhood, all I had to do was walk outside my door. My family had a sense of adventure not found in most people. When I was 5 years old, we moved to a small Eskimo village in the interior of Alaska. My parents were missionaries who met in college in California and found that their faith not only allowed them to spread Christianity, but also appealed to their sense of adventure. Besides his missionary work, my father worked for the state. The job required a college degree, and my father was one of the few people in the village that had one. My mother stayed home with us. She helped with homework and kept my sisters and me on track. I was the middle child between two sisters. We were a tight family because there wasn't a lot to do in the village. Winters were brutal, so we'd huddle around the kitchen table and play board games. But calling it a town by normal standards would be generous. We had two stores, together no bigger than a small truck stop, a small school, and a post office. No mall, no movie theater, but you could rent movies at one of the stores. The crown jewel of my town was the runway. It was just large enough to land a 737 jet, as well as some of the bigger propeller-driven cargo planes. That made our village the hub of the region. Bush planes would come in and out of town, bringing hunters and outdoorsmen from Anchorage to the more remote villages spread along the river. We lived in a two-story house 100 yards off the river. The house had a beautiful view of picturesque Alaska. Sometimes, when I was lucky, I could see a moose or a bear from my front door. If I wasn't in school, I was out hunting or fishing. From the time I was a little kid, I was comfortable using a gun and moving in the woods, and being responsible for myself. During Bud's training, I excelled at land warfare. It was really no different than my hunting trips as a kid. With varying backgrounds at Bud's, guys were stronger in different areas. I did fine in the water, too, but I felt most comfortable during the weapons and land warfare training. So when I got to DevGru, I typically acted as the point man for my assault team. On this cold night in Iraq, the 4-mile patrol to the target village took about an hour. It was close to 3 a.m. when we arrived. As we got close, I could see the lights from the Iraqi village flickering across the highway. It was a dusty shithole. Light blue plastic shopping bags blew down the street. The smell of raw sewage from a ditch that ran along the road hung on the wind. I could just make out the biscuit-colored houses, which had a faint green hue under my night vision goggles. The power lines that ran along the highway into Syria sagged. Everything looked ratty and run down. As we got to the village, the teams started to peel off to their predetermined targets. I led my team to our target building. Creeping up to the gate, I tried the handle. The heavy black iron door creaked open. Pushing it just wide enough to see in, I scanned the courtyard. It was empty. The front door of the two-story house had a large window covered by an ornate grate. I could see inside the foyer as my teammates' lasers searched inside from the first-floor windows. I slowly pushed open the front door of the house. It was unlocked. I paused at the threshold, my rifle at the ready, and waited. Looking over my shoulder, one of my teammates gave me a thumbs up. I blinked the dust out of my eyes to make sure I could see before stepping inside. I was wearing my cumbersome op gear over a winter jacket as I tried to move like a cat. Think quiet, I told myself. The foyer was cramped. A small generator sat on the floor. There was a door straight ahead of me and another door to my right. Ignoring the door to the right because it was blocked by a generator, I crept through the door in front of me. My senses were on fire. I strained to hear any movement up ahead as I scanned the empty room. The smell of kerosene from the family's heating stove attacked my nostrils. Every step that I took seemed like a huge crash. We were trained to anticipate an insurgent with a suicide vest or an AK-47 behind any door ready to attack. Curtains covered the doorway leading back to the bedrooms. I hated the curtains because, at least with the door, you felt a little protected. I had no idea if someone was looking under the curtain or was just waiting for my shadow to pass in front so that he could shoot. This was the end game. There was no way these rooms would be empty. We had no idea if the occupants had heard us. On my previous deployment with Delta, several of their guys were killed when they entered a house and got ambushed by a fighter hiding behind a sandbag wall. It was a deadly lesson we never forgot, and it was always in the back of our minds as we entered a target. I paused for a second or two, hoping to draw out any impatient ambushers. The light was on in the room behind the curtain. Flipping my night vision goggles up, I slowly pulled the curtain aside. A long, slender refrigerator stood at the elbow of an L-shaped hallway. I spotted a door ajar and moved to quickly cover it while my teammates flooded the hallway, clearing the other rooms. One of my teammates followed me as we pushed open the door and cleared into a bedroom. There was no talking. Everyone knew his job. 3 mattresses were on the floor, and I could barely make out 2 eyes staring at me from the corner of the dark room. It was a young man with wispy facial hair and dark eyes. He seemed nervous, and his eyes kept shifting from side to side as we moved inside. It struck me as odd that he just sat there, staring at me. There were 2 women, also awake, staring at the door. I immediately started moving toward the man. I knew something wasn't right because men usually sleep in a different room. As I passed the women, I held my hand out, waving at them to be calm. The man started to try and talk,
Shh, I whispered. I didn't want him to alert any men who might be in another room. His gaze never left me. I grabbed him by his right arm and yanked him up, pushing the blankets away to make sure he didn't have a weapon. Holding him against the wall, I pulled the blankets off the women. Sleeping between the women was a small girl, no more than 5 or 6 years old. When I moved the blanket off of her, the girl's mother grabbed her and pulled her close. I guided the man into the center of the room and secured his hands together with flex cuffs, plastic handcuffs, and slid a hood over his head. My teammate watched the women while I quickly searched the man's pockets. I then pushed the man to his knees and shoved his head into the corner. He tried to talk, but I pressed his face against the wall, muffling his voice. Our troop chief, who was running the mission, popped his head in the door. "What do you have?" he said. "One, ma'am," I said, which is shorthand for military-aged male. "Still need to search the room." I walked to the far corner of the room, next to the mattresses, and saw the brown stock of an AK-47. Resting on a pile of small plastic bags was a green chest rack used to carry extra magazines and a grenade. "Got an AK over here," I said. "Chest rack, grenade." Fuck. I was pissed we hadn't seen the weapons earlier.
My teammate who covered the women hadn't seen them either when we came into the room.
The man I found in the room was definitely a fighter, and a smart one, too. He hid his gun, chest rack, and hand grenades just out of reach and well enough for us not to see them on our initial entry into the room. Everything inside me wanted to shoot this guy right there on the spot. He knew the rules we had to follow, and he was using them against us. We couldn't shoot him unless he posed a threat. If he had any balls, he would have lit us up coming through the door. He knew we were in the house. The man must have heard us come in and thought he could hide with the women. With the house secure, I led the man to another room to question him. The room's floor was covered in rugs, and sleeping mats were piled in a heap in the center of the room. A TV on the floor was on, but the screen was just static. Our interpreter stood next to the man as I pulled the hood off. His face was sweaty, and his eyes were big as he tried to adjust to the light. "Ask him why he had grenades in a chest rack," I told the interpreter. "I am a guest here," the man said. "Why were you sleeping with the women and children? Guests don't sleep next to the women." "One of them is my wife," he said. "But I thought you were a guest here," I said. The questioning went on like that for about an hour. He never got his story straight, and the next morning we turned him over to the Marines. It was frustrating because missions were like this day after day. It was a catch-and-release system. We'd roll them up, and in a few weeks the fighter would be back on the street. I was confident the fighter we found in the bedroom would be released soon.
The only way to permanently take them off the street was if they were dead. We found out later from some of the village elders that the men, including the fighter I encountered in the women's bedroom, were part of an insurgent cell that rotated between the houses of the village.
The guy we captured had gone home that night to stay with his family. Three other guys in his cell were killed that same night after a short firefight with my teammates. My teammates got lucky and got the jump on them before the insurgents reacted. Our troop uncovered guns, mines, and explosives for roadside bombs in the house. After clearing our initial targets, our troop searched the majority of the houses in the village. In one of the bedrooms, I found a pile of bras in one of the drawers. I fished out a nice white one with lace and a bow at the center. Balling it up, I stuffed it into the cargo pocket in my pants for later. Outside, the bop, bop, bop of the Marines' massive CH-53 helicopters echoed over the village. The sun was coming up as we held security positions in a nearby house. It was freezing. Mornings always seemed to be the coldest part of the day. I looked up in time to see what looked like two big gray school buses fly over me, make a 90-degree turn, and settle into the open desert just north of the power lines. The ramps in the back dropped down, and out came the Marines, just like you've seen in their commercials. My troop chief walked past me to coordinate with the Marines so we could turn over the village and go home. "You see their HQ?" he said. "I think they're down the road," I said, pointing toward a cluster of men and radio antennas. As he passed by, I fished out the bra from earlier that night and discreetly draped it on a radio antenna attached to his back. When it was cold and miserable, it is the little things that warm you up. As he passed some of the Marines, I saw them stare at him and laugh.
Hey, where's your HQ? The troop chief asked a nearby Marine. He pointed down the road.
Hey, sir, you got a bra hanging off your back, the Marine said.
Yeah, I'm sure there is, the troop chief said without hesitation, glancing back in our direction.
Happens all the time.
On the patrol back to the landing zone in the desert, I noticed something in my peripheral vision blowing in the wind. Reaching back, I pulled on a bra strap. Someone had hung a bra on the bolt cutters I had strapped to my back. Pranks on the team were a way of life. The pranking was so frequent that the squadron eventually built a wire diagram connecting all the suspected culprits. We used this same wire diagram to track terrorists. We had the names of all the guys in a pyramid with the worst prankster on top. Phil, my team leader at the time. Phil had been in the Navy forever. He graduated Green Team the year I graduated Buds, left DevGrew for a break, and joined the Leapfrogs, the Navy's parachute demonstration team. He also served as a military freefall instructor before returning to the command. I met Phil during my first days at the squadron and instantly liked him. He did several tours as an assaulter, then headed up the squadron's combat assault dog program before becoming my team leader. Phil was a great prankster, maybe the best. At least once I came back to my cage and found the shoelaces on all of my boots for my right foot cut. I couldn't prove Phil did it. I knew he had large magnets, which he'd wave over your wallet to demagnetize the strip on your credit card. He was famous for bombing all of your gear with glitter. I don't know how many pouches and uniforms I had to replace because purple glitter was caked on the Velcro or trapped in the folds of the fabric. When things got slow, he'd create a feud.
All right, who pranked me?
He would yell, walking into the team room. But we all knew he pranked himself. He was trying to stir up a war because he was bored. Sometimes the guys did get him back. One Friday night after work, we all walked into the parking lot to find Phil's car high in the air. One of his victims, and it was never clear who, picked up his car with a forklift and left it there. One of the longest-running pranks in the squadron started with Phil. When we weren't deployed, we trained all over the United States.
On this night, we were in Miami doing some urban training.
It was just getting dark, and we were scheduled to practice CQB in an old abandoned hotel. Before we started training, Phil and the local police, who kept onlookers away, went in to make sure it was empty. We didn't want to start training and run up on some homeless squatter. At the time, Phil was still working as a dog handler. As they walked the halls, Phil glanced into a room and saw something sticking out of the drywall. It was a giant 12-inch black dildo. Sliding on a rubber glove, Phil pulled it out of the wall and carried it downstairs.
"Look what I found," he said, waving it over his head. "Get that thing away from me," I said, backing away as it flopped back and forth in his hand.
With the hotel clear, we started to train. It was just before dawn when we finished. After I put my kid into the trunk of my rental car, I was exhausted and I collapsed behind the wheel. As I went to start the car, I noticed that I had something attached to my steering wheel.
"Phil!" I yelled, practically jumping out of the car to get away from it.
I looked around, but Phil was gone. He already fled the scene of the crime. The dildo was strapped to my steering wheel. It stretched from the 9 o'clock to 3 o'clock position. I cut it off the steering wheel and put it in a random helmet in one of the equipment bags. The dildo, which came to be called the Staff of Power, disappeared. We forgot about it for a few months, until back in Virginia Beach after we finished some gas mask training. Since DevGru is tasked with hunting down weapons of mass destruction, we often trained in the kill house in full chemical suits. The gas masks took a while to get used to, and we had to be comfortable operating in the suits and masks for long periods. It was the end of the day, and we all came up to the team room after to get a beer. I walked in and headed over to the refrigerator. Popping the cap and taking a long pull, I turned back and saw some of the guys huddled around the foot of the conference table.
"Holy shit," I heard one of them say. "No way. That isn't it, is it?"
another one said. I walked over to the crowd and saw a Polaroid picture taped to a blank sheet of paper. The Staff of Power was coiled in someone's gas mask. As soon as I saw the picture, my stomach flipped. I had no idea where the staff had been before Phil snagged it, and now it could have been in my gas mask. The same mask I spent hours in that day. I tried to see if the mask in question was mine, but the picture was shot so tightly it was impossible to tell. In that minute, the staff of power was in everybody's mask, and no one was going to take a chance. I followed the crowd down.